From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Since the police arrest of two innocent black men at a Philadelphia Starbucks several weeks ago, the internet seems to be flooded with a news story seemingly every other day of white people calling the police on black people for no good reason. A white golf player calling police on five black women golfers, a white woman calling the cops on two black men in Oakland for barbecuing, a white Yale student calling police on a black Yale student who was simply napping, a white neighbor calling police on the black guests of an Airbnb as they were getting ready to leave, and on and on. It is common knowledge that when police encounter black people, there is a very real possibility of it turning into a fatal interaction. Should we view the police as a weapon in the hands of whites against blacks? My guest is Jody Armour. He is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California. He's also the author of Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America, and a Soros Justice Senior Fellow of the Open Society Institute Center on Crime, Communities, and Culture. He's also the race and criminal justice correspondent for our program. Welcome back to the show, Jody.
It's always good to be with you, Sonali.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these individual incidents so we can get a sense of them. Like, I'm sure our audience has seen one or more of them. I mentioned the Starbucks incident, which became the most well-known, but since then, so many incidents have cropped up. But one that's gotten a lot of attention is the white woman who was so upset about two black men barbecuing in Oakland because they were apparently using a charcoal barbecue, which she had decided was illegal in that very spot in the park. And so she remained in the park next to them for 2 hours waiting for the police after she had called them. What do you make of this incident?
Sonali, you know, I wrote the book that you mentioned, Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was about the black tax, what I called racial profiling, the cost that black people pay because of stereotypes about blacks. And it appears that here now, 20 years later, ain't nothing changed but the year it is. We have the same set of concerns and problems about blacks and non-blacks viewing blacks as more suspicious than similarly situated non-blacks. And I say not non-blacks, the cases you're mentioning so far have involved white folk calling the police in on what they saw as suspicious black folk. But you'll also notice that in a number of those incidents, when you're looking at the video that you mentioned, there are black officers there to enforce the white person's concerns and fears, and you might say, to be a conduit for the white person's discrimination and bias, if that's what we're going to call this. So what you're seeing again and again is this black tax problem. And one other thing that struck me, Sonali, that I want to kind of get out and mention in this flurry of videos that you refer to is that, you know, we've often blamed the white working class for Trump. Right. We're want to do that. You've seen it since the election as a way of scapegoating one part of the white community and absolving the rest. But what you see in these cases over and over, the Yale PhD student who called on a black Yale woman, the Oakland case that you talk about involving the barbecue, that's a Stanford PhD graduate. All right. When you talk about a Starbucks, you know, you're talking about kind of, you're not necessarily anymore talking about poor whites as has been the stereotype. What you're seeing is that racial resentment and the willingness to weaponize the police against black folk is something that well-educated middle and upper middle class white folk are perfectly willing to engage in and participate in.
The Oakland incident was really interesting because the wife of one of the men, I believe, she was a white woman herself, started videotaping the white caller and confronted her and then essentially followed her to the police, just wouldn't leave her alone, was questioning her. And when the original, the white woman who called the police, finally found an officer, she began crying and talked about being harassed. And she, you could see the sigh of relief, this relief she felt being in the presence of a police officer. Is it safe to say that whites generally know it's a given that they can feel safe around police, whereas the opposite is true among Black communities and to some extent non-Black communities of color?
Yeah, you're spot on there. I'll start with your point about the white woman who was videotaping the caller, the 911 caller, the white woman, the PhD, I'll say the doctorate, the Stanford doctorate, so we get this class point on the table when we're talking about this. That white woman showed you the meaning, who was doing the videotaping, showed you the meaning of allyship in the age of Black Lives Matter, right? Allies can render a very important service in exposing how widespread bias is, because there's so many of us in denial about it.
And right, so the videotaper was essentially using her privilege in a constructive way.
That's it, spot on. I could not possibly have said it any better. And also you saw in the Oakland case, the weaponizing of white women's tears that you can see in these cases too often. You know, this kind of white damsel in distress that needs rescuing by these officers of the state who have a monopoly on legitimate violence. Bring in the badges and the guns and let me cinch my case by having a lot of tears flow. And so I think, you know, these cases really have us thinking hard again about intersectionality, right? And recognizing that even though women are certainly a marginalized group, and in the Me Too moment that we're in, we're focusing on that marginalization as we should. But we have to also recognize that sometimes people from those same marginalized groups turn around and marginalize other people from different stereotype groups, and should especially feel uncomfortable and maybe even hypocritical in catching themselves doing that.
So let's also discuss how it is that white people who do call the cops on Black folks seem to not pay much of a price when they do it in an unreasonable way, right? Obviously, if you see somebody in a very serious way breaking the law or endangering themselves or someone else, it's a legitimate issue. But if you're calling the cops because you see somebody napping or somebody leaving a house with baggage because they were living there or staying there or they were golfing too slowly or whatever, and you call the cops on such a minor issue, there doesn't seem to be much price that these people pay for calling the cops, using city resources to tackle something so minor when they really should be called on to tackle the major issues.
Well, yeah, they not only don't they pay a price, but they actually are rewarded because very often the police will arrive and, for example, at Starbucks, arrest the patrons or take some kind of official action against the people that made the white person somehow feel uncomfortable. So you have that kind of encouragement on the one hand, Sonali, but on the other, there's also a video that went viral that I think you can see another kind of response from police officers, because police officers in these situations, like in Starbucks, have a lot of discretion. They don't have to arrive on the scene and necessarily or call the person a trespasser or arrest the person. Whether or not that Black person sitting in Starbucks is a trespasser isn't something that the proprietor can, just because the proprietor says so, make them that. You know, the proprietor can't put up a sign and say, you know, no Black customers served here in this place of public accommodation, and have police come and enforce that because a Black person is a trespasser, they're violating that signage. Well, even though we know they can't constitutionally do that by putting up a sign, they're in effect doing that if they're profiling their black customers and calling in the police. So the police, when they arrive, have to exercise common sense and discretion. So for the video I was mentioning to you that went viral involved a black real estate agent, I think in Memphis, Tennessee, who is looking at a property and he's getting ready to go in and take some pictures. He's an investor, and a white woman next door tells him to get out and starts objecting to him being there and calls the police on him. And the police arrive and he starts videotaping it. The police arrive and he explains who he is and he shows his credentials, and the police go to her and they tell her and him in front of her that she should not call them again. And if she in any way interferes with him doing what he has a right to do, they will come and arrest her.
Wow.
So that's showing the police don't have to be automatons. They don't have to mechanically just arrive and take whoever called them's word for the situation. They have to exercise some common sense as well.
Right. Jody, I'm sure you've had so many personal incidents of your own to relate. I'm not black, but as a person of color, I've been put in such situations when about a year ago, I haven't really talked about this publicly, but I wanted to share this with you, that I would go on walks early in the morning in my neighborhood, and one neighbor had a terrible barking dog situation. He just never controlled his dog, and I got sick of it. I tried everything, those dog whistles. So one day, finally, I tried one of those noise-making things that are used to try to deter dogs from barking. Well, the neighbor finally came out and started yelling at me and threatened to call the cops on me. I said, all right, go ahead. And I kept walking, reached my home. A couple of hours later, a cop showed up to my doorstep. So this white neighbor, a middle-class, seemingly well-educated white neighbor, thought it fit to call the cops on a brown woman in his neighborhood who tried to shut his dog up using a noisemaker. And the cop did his bidding, treated me with suspicion, instantly believed him over me. And it was quite shocking to me. How did he know where I lived? And it was a very traumatic incident for me. Because the cop kept putting his hand on his gun. And I can only imagine how much higher the stakes would have been had I been a black woman. So I'm sure you have such incidents too. And I just want to say, personally speaking, white people stop calling the cops on people of color, and especially black Americans, because you put our lives in danger when you do that.
Yes, stop calling the cops on us when we're doing ordinary things. Like you said when you started the show, if you see anybody doing anything flagrantly illegal, of course, call the police. But don't call the cops on blacks who are Starbucking, napping, Airbnb-ing, barbecuing, breathing, right? Don't call the cops on blacks for ordinary activities. That's what's so problematic. And with your story hits close to my heart, Sonali, because I really came to law school to go into contracts and teach commercial transaction. I was interested in law and economics and started writing about social and racial justice because my wife had your very experience. Hmm. We had our first baby. She's walking through this predominantly white neighborhood in McCandless outside of Pittsburgh, and the police call on her while she has the baby in a hammock, right? And she's walking, getting exercise after the baby came. The neighbors called and said that a black woman was in the neighborhood going through their garbage. And the police came out and came to our home, and which was a decent home, nice home in a nice neighborhood, and asked her if she was going through their garbage, right? And here's a Harvard-educated black woman, and here's a professor of law, and we're standing in front of you, and you're going to actually, and she has the baby here in a hammock, and you're going to actually ask her if she's going through the garbage. And so that is the kind of thing where we have to recognize that police officers are street-level bureaucrats. That's essentially what they are. And as any bureaucrat, they have a lot of discretion that they can exercise. They need to exercise that discretion that they have with some prudence and with some sense of in an inclusive way and in an equitable way, and not allow themselves to be conduits of social prejudices.
Jody, it's not just, of course, that police interaction can end fatally for Black folks in America. But also, oftentimes, we have this exact same dynamic playing out when people are fit the description of the suspect, and you have so many stories where people have been wrongfully incarcerated, sometimes for years, for crimes they did not commit simply because they were seen as suspicious or the suspect. And then, of course, you have the kinds of interactions that unfortunately Mike Brown and Stephon Clark had, where they're simply killed.
Yeah, cross-racial identification is notoriously error-ridden. We really do have a much easier time identifying and recognizing nuances in social groups that we're around a lot, that we're very familiar with, than in out-groups, than in social groups that we're not. So, when you have eyewitness testimony in cases that are involving minorities or others, often in the eyes of the jurors, the witness, in a lot of these cases, you can have a really error-ridden problem. But we're looking at, Sonali, it seems to me, an old problem in a lot of ways, the problem of the Black tax, as I called it in my first book, that cuts across class, like Stevie Wonder said, you might make big cash, but you cannot cash in your face. And the face of crime for many Americans is Black, and that figures in how they're responded to, not just by police. We've talked a lot about in the Black Lives Matter moment that we've been in, state discrimination and state brutality. But these cases that you're talking about now, Sonali, are showing us how beyond police officers, although they could come into the equation later, we have a lot of these issues among our countrymen and countrywomen. Right. This is a problem. This is a problem just not just of police forces, but of people like Aaron Schlossberg in New York, the New York lawyer who's gone viral for berating a woman and people for speaking Spanish in a restaurant. Right. We're seeing that lawyers, New York lawyers and doctors and not just police. These are issues that we have as a collective to deal with. We need to approach them as a collective problem that needs a collective solution, as a public health problem more than anything else.
Well, Jody, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure we'll have you back on our program very soon. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you, Sonali.
Jody Armour is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America. He's also Soros Justice Senior Fellow of the Open Society Institute Center on Crime, Communities, and Culture. And he's our race and criminal justice correspondent. We've been discussing cops as white weapons against Black folks. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.